He is my good friend, been a good friend since a couple years after I first got sober. I go to H&I with him at the Corcoran every week, and you guys already know him and you love him. Give it up for Bill H.
Well, good evening, friends. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bill Hatchman. And I'm glad to be here tonight. I do want to let you know, you know what? Let me start with something else. I've learned from you that the very best things in my life come when I ask for help. And so let me just share a prayer with you that I use pretty regularly. It goes something like this. Heavenly Father, thank you for another sober day here on earth. I ask you to show me your will for me and to give me the courage and the strength to carry it out. I pray that you'd use me to help build your kingdom. And I ask that you show me all the blessings that you've put in my life. Help me to be grateful for them. Help me to be a good steward with them and help me to share them. I pray that you would use me to help benefit other people. And I just ask that you would use me as an instrument of your peace today. It's in your name that I pray. Amen. So a couple little logistics. I started this group in 2008, in September of 2008. I think that's close to, how many years is that? 14 years. 14 years ago, I got this notion. I was about 3 years sober in AA here in Visalia, and I knew what you guys needed. I did. I knew that you needed to hear more from me. And I figured the best way for you to get to hear more about me is if I started a speaker meeting. And I don't know if this has ever happened to you, where you kind of think you know what you're doing, and you take some action, and then you realize what you just did and how silly it was. And so for the next 5 years, I booked speakers to come up here and tell their story. And I very intentionally did not ask myself to share. Which is kind of funny, right? Because, I mean, I was thinking this was my great opportunity to get to share. And it was 5 years before I gave in and decided to tell my story here. And we have a speaker. What do we call it? There's a position. I think we call it the director of this. Isn't that funny, right? The director of this group, and it's not me. And that person is who books the speakers. And the person that's been serving in that capacity has had some things happen recently, and has asked me to kind of fill in and schedule our speakers. And I'm kind of a lazy guy, if you want to know the truth. And it probably doesn't always look that way, but the way that I demonstrate my laziness is I like book like 6 months of speakers in one day, or maybe a couple of days. But I get it all done, and then I don't have to do it. Then I get to be lazy because it's done. I don't have to do anything for like 6 months. And so we had Lawrence from Tulare scheduled to speak tonight. And yesterday, when Israel reached out to confirm with Lawrence and make sure he had everything, he let us know that he was out of town, and he'd gotten kind of caught up in some weather, and he wasn't able to get home. And so we had to find another speaker. I reached out to I don't know, 3-4 different people and asked them if they could fill in. And none of them could. And I remember it was kind of a funny deal. Our director, the person who books our speakers, had asked me several months ago if I would speak because somebody didn't show up that night. And And I said, look, I'm happy to do it, but I'm here every week, so I'm happy to also just be a hot standby, right? So if you ever need somebody, I can fill in and I'll be here. And so I didn't speak a few months ago, and then today came up, and 2 days ago I celebrated 17 years, and it just seemed like the stars were kind of aligning. Maybe I should just do this. And then last night, one of the guys that I asked to speak, you guys probably know him, Albert. Albert also got sober in April, but many years before I did. And he's got a great story, and he's such a great speaker. I was excited to ask him if he would speak, and he was not able to make it. And last night, he hit me up. He said, hey, man, I know who can speak for you. You still don't have somebody. And I was like, oh, great, cool, I'm off, right? I don't have to do it, right? And there's another part of me that was saying, oh, I don't get to do it, you know? I mean, I'm just being honest. And I said, okay, who? And he wrote back, you. It's like, all right. So Albert sent me. Let's go with that. Can't question Albert. I told you I was an alcoholic. I know from our book that what I'm supposed to do is share in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And through all of that, I want to tell you, you guys might have noticed I dressed a little different today. I put on a sport coat and a tie and a nice shirt. It occurred to me that some people might not understand why I do that. And I'll tell you why I do it. I do it for the same reason that I dress nice when I got married and when I go to other special events, because I feel good dressed a little nicer doing things that are really important to me. And there's really nothing more important to me than this. So I hope you guys don't get the wrong impression. I'm not up here trying to act like I'm better than anybody. I'm trying to really just celebrate the life that you guys gave me. So I told you I'm an alcoholic, and what I have learned from our book is that what that means is something much different than what I thought it meant. When the term was first presented to me, I thought, maybe you guys thought the same thing, some of you maybe, I thought an alcoholic was a guy that didn't pay his bills, was, you know, probably living in a shady place, you know, was not to be trusted, behaved badly, smelled badly probably, right, dressed badly. When I look in the mirror, I don't see what I thought an alcoholic was. Even 17, 18 years ago, I didn't see that. I saw some problems, let me tell you, but I didn't see that. And I've had something of an education that has been really important for me, and that is understanding that an alcoholic isn't about any of those things. For me, why I say I'm an alcoholic is because, first, I have a problem with my mind. And the problem that I have with my mind is that I seem to forget that I can't safely drink. And most people who've had my experiences with drinking would come to the conclusion that it's not a good idea for a guy like me to drink. Because what happens is the second part of my problem. And that is when I put alcohol into my system, there's just a different chemical reaction in my body than there is in what most human beings experience. Now, if you asked most of you amongst ourselves, hey, did this happen to you when you drink? Well, you're here, so it probably did. Probably. But statistically, people who study human health and science and stuff, they believe that it's about 1 in 10 people, 1 in 10 humans have the same reaction that I have. That maybe have the reaction that you have. And the reaction is that when I put alcohol in my system, there's just something about drinking that makes me thirsty. And it doesn't happen with water or soda, but if it's got liquor in it, man, I believe some is good, and you know what that makes more? Makes it better, doesn't it? And I love me some drinking. You know? And I think maybe a good way to illustrate my experience around drinking is some of the earliest experiences I had with alcohol. I do need to make a disclaimer here. You know my wife is in the audience, so there's a little pressure on me to tell the truth tonight. But my wife's only known me for 14 years. My father is in the audience tonight, and he's known me all of my life. So I'm not going to get away with anything tonight. So when I was growing up, I don't remember the exact particulars, but I'm certain that that there were times, either with my grandfather opening a beer and giving me a sip, or my parents having a party and the friend and their friends having adult beverages, right? There were occasions that I would taste their drinks, right? But I don't remember anything particular happening around that. So my point is, I don't think the story I'm about to tell you is my first experience with alcohol. It's just the first one that I remember where there was something special about it, okay? And before I tell you that story, I want to tell you about a story that predates alcohol. This is seventh grade, Cherry Avenue Bulldogs. Any Cherry Avenue Bulldogs in the house? There we go. All right. Show out for that seventh and eighth grade. And so I was a seventh grader at Cherry Avenue High School, Junior High School in Tulare, and I got my first chance to go to a seventh grade dance. You guys remember that? Man, you know what? I don't think my dad's heard this story either. It was a Friday. They let us go home early from school. I went home. I took a shower. Like, you know, 13-year-old boys don't take a shower in the afternoon, right? I took a shower. I got out. My dad doesn't know this. I took his razor and I rubbed it up against my little 13-year-old face. And then I took some of his Aqua Velva and I splashed it on my face and it stung. You guys remember that? Oh, that stung, yeah. And I went to that dance. I put on my best shirt, did my hair back. Back then, we did our hair differently than we do today. And I went to the dance, went to the gymnasium, and I got to the door, and I looked in the door, and there she was, Cindy Rushing. I had to have me some Cindy Rushing. She was across the gymnasium, and I felt like I needed to have her. I don't know what I was going to do with her when I got her, but I had to have her. And I looked across the floor, and there she was, and she was with her cousin, and the two of them were laughing. And I don't know why, but for some reason in my head, I internalized that, and it was they were laughing at me, like they didn't like my shirt, or my jeans weren't right, or I don't know what. It shook my confidence. I never did talk to Cindy that night. I walked in there, and I stood against the wall with my back, and I watched other kids have fun, and I hated them all. I was so envious of them. I didn't have words for that then. I just knew I didn't like the experience. So fast forward now 2 years. I'm a freshman in high school, and because of some sports I was in, I knew a kid that was a junior, and you remember Al Moore? Yeah, Al came and picked me up for my first high school dance and got in the back seat. He had a Chevelle or something. He had a hot rod car, and I got in the back seat of the car, and there was a 16-ounce can of beer rolling around in the back there, and you know, I don't remember ever really particularly drinking beer, but I knew what it was. I asked them if I could have it, and I'm convinced that I did that because I wanted to fit in, because they were doing it. And I drank that beer real fast on the way over, and I went to that dance and got in there, and now I had the time of my life. I danced with so many girls that night. I mean, I even, you know, this was way before it was cool to do this. I danced alone a couple of times. I mean, I was cutting a rug that night. Now, that night, I got home to my house on time. I didn't spend any money I wasn't supposed to spend. I didn't have any fights I wasn't supposed to have. I didn't break up with anybody. There were no telltale signs of a problem with alcohol that night. And it would be many, many years later before I would learn that something very tragic happened to me that night. And what happened to me that night is I began to believe two lies. And the first lie was that you liked me better when I was drinking. That somehow there was a better version of me that came out. And so my drinking was really just a public service. I was doing it for you. You know? And the second lie that I began to believe was that I really did become a better version of me. I became a better dancer. I became a smoother talker. I became better looking, taller, stronger, faster. All the things that I was afraid I wasn't enough of. I felt like I was enough of when I got some alcohol in my system. And I just had one tall buy. Now, when I got the opportunity to drink after that, I would take it. And progressively, as we read in our book, progressively, my relationship with alcohol grew. And I began to drink more and more and more frequently. And And it's really just a matter of basic chemistry and biology. When you put enough alcohol in your system, there are some very predictable things that happen. And the kinds of things that happen to the human when they put alcohol in your system is you start to lose your inhibitions, right? You start doing and saying things that you wouldn't normally do and say. And for me, that gets to a level of where I'm behaving in ways that are contrary to my value system. I'm doing things that are not okay with me. And I don't know if you can relate to that, but what happens for me in that situation is I wake up the next morning and I've got me all over me. You know? I mean, it doesn't start off that way. It starts off kind of fun, you know? Like your friends will call you the next day and you go, "Dude, you remember what you did last night?" And it's all cute and funny, right? And then over a period of time, it's not cute and funny anymore. It's just kind of mildly irritating. And then it gets just outright disgusting and shameful. But see, you know what I do is I go to the party and I stay longer than the friends I came with. And I end up drinking with the other people that drink like I drink. And over a period of time, I don't even recognize this, but now I've taken on a whole new set of friends. I'm only hanging out with the people that drink like that. I have no frame of reference. I've lost it. And there's always that one guy, right? At least one guy that drinks more than me. And I say, as long as I don't get as bad as him, I'm okay. Right? And, God, I remember I was in the Army. One of my fellows in my unit had drank too much, and he ended up getting arrested. And it evolved into a bad situation. They took him into the hospital. I didn't know it at the time. They put him in treatment. I had no idea. I just knew he was in the hospital. And he had to stop drinking. I mean, he had to, like, stop drinking, like, forever. And I remember thinking, I didn't know anything about AA or what that meant. I just thought, oh, my God, that would be a horrible thing to happen to you, that you'd have to stop drinking forever. I mean, that's miserable. And progressively over the years, things continue to get worse and worse. So I'll tell you one story that might really kind of illustrate just how bad things can get. There were lots and lots of stories, maybe not as egregious as this, but I decided to go to Lake Havasu with a friend of mine. And this friend of mine, coincidentally, happened to also be my sister's now ex-husband. So I wasn't supposed to be hanging around with my friend, right? Because it's kind of like disloyal to my sister. But you see, he and I liked to party the same way. And so I drove out to the desert to see him, and we had a plan. We were going to rent a boat. We were going to get lots of beer. And we were going to go out on the water and just have fun. We were going to do stuff. And we did. And it got to be later in the afternoon. And I realized, hey, you know what? We haven't gone water skiing yet. And we've been drinking all day. And so I jump in the water. And I'm too drunk. I can't get up on the skis. So I get back in the boat. And now I'm driving. And he gets in the water. And this sucker gets up. And I'm a little envious. Now, I'm not angry at him, you know, but I'm a little envious of him, and so I'm playful. And after he finally falls, I come bring the boat around to kind of pick him up, and I decide it would be funny if I turn in front of him, throw a wake of water at him. And I misjudged the distance. And I didn't know what was wrong, but I knew something was desperately wrong when I turned that wheel and went around that corner. There was just something in my stomach that said something really bad just happened. And I turn around and I see my friend, and the water around him is getting a darker color. And cut to the chase, the story is I ended up hitting him with the propeller, and it cut him 3 times. And to this day, I still don't know how I maneuvered the boat over to pick him up, but I remember very graphically. Some nights I'm awakened by this, but pulling him out of the water and seeing his hip bone through one of the lacerations. And that was... that's a pretty deep cut, and there was a lot of blood. And got him to the dock, and they called the ambulance, and then they called the police. And so not only did my carelessness injure my friend, but then the next thing that I end up doing is I ask my dad to carry that lie, to not tell my sister what I've done. And That's kind of how I roll, you know? I'm not really too terribly concerned about how my accidents impact other people. You know, it would take a year after that before my friend would finish his physical therapy and all the treatment for his wounds. And I remember about a year after the incident, he was still sending me receipts, and I was ordered by the court to pay his expenses. So I was sending him the money. I was very begrudgingly sending him that money. And I remember, and I'm not proud, I'm ashamed of this, but I remember thinking he was milking me for money. You guys get that, right? That's how distorted my views are. And anyway, that's just one situation. So I left a lot of people in my wake over the years. I've been engaged 4 times and married twice, and there's some things that, you know, making amends is a difficult thing to do for. So it was February 14th of 2004. I was sleeping off another one. And it was early in the morning, and my girlfriend at the time and my mom and my sister woke me up. And they brought me into the living room, and the rest of my sisters and their husbands, and the house was full of people. And you might recognize this kind of surprise party. You guys, you ever had a surprise party like that? There's no bounce house, there's no pony, right? In fact, I just noticed Grass was here. He was there too. And these people sat around and they told me these stories about some of the good times in our life, and then inevitably some of those stories got to be a little embarrassing and kind of sad, and then ultimately they all ended the same way, and they all asked me to go get help, and I had to do it that day. And they told me that if I didn't accept their offer for help, that, you know, I was certainly capable to make that choice, but that they weren't going to continue to watch me kill myself. And they got me at just the right time. I was beaten down. I was out of answers. I was spending more money than I was making to keep a party going with one. You guys ever been to a party of one? Yeah. It's not as much fun as it sounds, huh? So I went away to treatment for about 30 days. I came back home, and guess what? I came home, and I brought me with me. You know how that went? Yeah. And I got thirsty. And I rationalized, and I justified my drinking. And my family, they actually made good on their promises. And I was the gig was up, man. I couldn't show up for family events and holidays like I had, and be doing what I wanted to do, and slowly but surely life got a little more lonely than I like it to be. I'm a people person. I like to be around people, and I didn't always know it, obviously, with my behavior, but it turns out that being a part of my family is a really important thing to me. And maybe someday when I have some more time, I can tell you a little more in detail about what that looks like. But part of my bottom, if you will, was coming to the realization that if I didn't change, I was going to live a quality of life that I was not interested in living. And I don't know if any of you have been there, but it is abnormal. It is not normal for us to think that life would be better if we weren't here. And maybe some of you have had that thought. Maybe some of you are having that thought. And what I want to tell you is, if you are having those thoughts, those thoughts are temporary. And if you do something to get help, they're temporary in a very good way. And if you don't, they might be temporary in a very unfortunate way. But those are abnormal thoughts. It is not ordinary. It is not normal for us to have those kinds of thoughts. But I've had them. And I guess I'm just really kind of glad I wasn't. I used to think I wasn't courageous enough. I think the truth is I wasn't stupid enough. When I think back on it today, I wasn't stupid enough to end my own life because I didn't know any better. So you guys kept talking about getting these sponsors, and I would go to these meetings and. There would be people talking about the way they drank and the way they thought and the way they behaved, and I could relate to some of that. And there were invariably times when I would be at a meeting and I would hear somebody tell their story and I would think, man, that person really understands my experience. And what that led me to believe was that if they understood me, if they had the same problem that I had, that maybe what was working for them might work for me. And I would leave that meeting with a lot of hope. The problem is I didn't do anything with that. So I'd get in my car and I'd head home, and I would think to myself, "That's it, man. I'm gonna live sober. I'm gonna be sober. I'm staying sober, and I'm gonna be happy about it too." And I'd get a quarter of a mile down the road, and there'd be that other thought, you know. I don't know if you guys ever had that other thought, you know? Dude, you know you're going to drink. Just get it over with. Why are you torturing yourself? You know you're going to get loaded, man. Let's just go do it. And then that other thought, no, man. You remember what they said at the meeting, man? Remember what they said? No, don't do that. And there were times, in fact, I'd leave the Alano Club at noon. Man, I was on a high horse. I was going to stay sober the rest of my life. And I'd get down to where I was supposed to turn to go to my house, and my car would keep driving. And I go to the liquor store, and there was that day. If you haven't had this happen, this is a special kind of thing to have happen. I walked in, put a six-pack on the counter. I looked to my left, and the guy to my left was at the noon meeting I just left. Damn it! I still went home and got drunk. But eventually, I began to string together enough days, and you know, I think for me, I think I was staying sober on fear. You know, fear kept me sober for a while. And then it didn't. And what happened for me was I had a minor medical procedure. And the doctor thought that maybe it'd be a good idea to have some pain medication. And I don't want to distort anyone's primary purpose, but I can't take pain medication safely either. My body reacts very similar to those things as it does to alcohol, and so what happened is I had a sponsor that was going to pick up the pain medications and dispense them to me, and then something happened, and I fell outside of his supervision, and I found myself at the pharmacy. And I picked up the pills, and I took twice the prescribed amount before I even left the store. And I don't know what you do at a moment like that, but I pick up a case of beer on the way out. Just what I did. And I drank that whole weekend. Now here's the problem: I woke up on Monday morning, the 11th of April of 2005, and I forgot to tell my alarm clock that I had resigned from AA because I'd been drinking that whole weekend. My alarm clock went off, and my feet by that time had been trained. By that time, I had, for 128 days, 6 days a week, I would get up, get in my car, drive to the Alano Club, do the morning meeting, and then go back home. And I just got up and I just did it. And as I was driving to the Alano Club, it occurred to me that I had drank. And I had a plan. And my plan was that I wasn't going to tell anybody because 128 days, if you don't know this, is just a little bit over 4 months. And I had my eye on that five-month chip. I was going to get that five-month chip. I wasn't telling nobody. And I walked into that meeting, and for the first time at that meeting, they asked me to read the daily reflections. And by the time I'm done reading it, I'm crying in front of a bunch of strangers. And I'm telling you, man, I can't believe it. I did it again, man. I drank again. I can't believe it. And there was a guy in the back of the room. I was telling everybody there that I had a plan. I knew what I was going to do. I was going to volunteer to serve the Red Cross. The Katrina hurricane had just gone through New Orleans, and they were looking for people to go help in the rescue aid efforts. And I thought, that's what I need. That'll keep me sober. And Jeremy said, dude, why don't you just volunteer at the Alano Club? We need help here. And he said, why don't you call your sponsor? And I don't know why, but I did. I called my sponsor. I called Paul. And I told Paul, I said, you better sit down, Paul. I got news for you. And, you know, he wasn't even surprised. I mean, like, not even at all. And I told him, I said, man, I need your help. I will do anything to live sober. And he said, well, you're going to have to show me. And I said, yeah, man, just tell me what to do. Anything. I will do anything. And he said, well, you know, 128 days ago, I asked you to read a couple pages and answer a couple of questions. And maybe you should start there. And for some reason, I was just hurting enough that I made a commitment to him that I would do that every single day, that I would sit with a piece of paper and a pencil in my hand for at least 5 minutes, and I would write the answer to his questions, or I would write whatever else was going on, and we call that journaling around here, and I did that every single day for at least 10 months, and by the time I got to the day where that broke, because I don't know, I was traveling out of town or something, I had managed to work with my sponsor through the 10th step. And by the time I got to my first year, we had just finished the 12th step assignment he had given me. And I'm not here to tell you how you should work your steps. I don't know how long it should take you. I don't know how you should do it. I know how my sponsor did it with me. And if you ask me for help, I'm going to show you what he showed me. I'm going to share my experience with you. And shortly after that that one-year anniversary, my sponsor moved out of town. And I thought, that's okay. I'm a pretty metropolitan kind of guy. I can have an out-of-town sponsor. And I found pretty quickly that I was getting kind of edgy at meetings. You ever be at a meeting and like somebody says something and it kind of pisses you off? For me, that's a really good sign there's a problem with me. I mean, there might be a problem with you too, but there's a problem with me. And so fortunately, I got a hold of another sponsor, and I had a guy take me through the 12 steps again. I don't remember how long it took that time. It was less than a year that time. And then after that, the guy that I was working with suggested that I go to a group, and we did this like step workshop kind of thing over a 5-week period. And so I went through the steps that way, and then I got another sponsor, and we went through the steps again, and then that guy died, and so I got another sponsor, and I'll never forget. If some of you know a guy named Kenny Holcomb, Kenny was a pillar in our community, and Kenny took me through the steps one time, and I remember Kenny was celebrating his AA anniversary at a meeting at the Visalia Rescue Mission. He was doing a lot of work there at the time, and I went into this room, and the room was packed full of people. And, you know, this isn't really a good thing necessarily, but sometimes it happens. When you're celebrating somebody's birthday, it's like everybody that shares just shares about that person, right? And it's kind of sweet, but I was really touched because at that meeting, everybody who said something had like this really impressive story about how Kenny had affected their lives. And I don't know about you, but I was sitting there thinking, man, I want to be like Kenny. I want to affect other people's lives in the way that Kenny has affected people's lives. And my first sponsor, I remember I was at a meeting with about 90 days sober. It was this current streak of 90 days. And there was a guy, I think he was from Pine at the time, and he came up to me on a Friday night and asked me if I'd sponsor him. And see, now at that time, I'd been sober 90 days before. So I don't know how you refer to it, but the way I referred to it was I was 90 days sober again, right? And what that kind of infers is I'm probably going to be 90 days sober again, right? And so I was afraid, this guy asked me for help, I was afraid that I might harm him in some way. I was afraid that sharing my experience with this guy, because I had such bad experience, was going to lead this guy astray, and I was afraid of hurting him. And so I called I told the guy, I said, hey, here, by the way, if you don't want to sponsor somebody, if you don't want to do something, I'm going to give you the key how to get out of it, okay? And you're probably going to use this on me, because I'm going to ask probably most of you to do some shit around here. But here's how you do it. Here's how you politely get out of doing anything. Let me talk to my sponsor about that, and I'll get back to you. That's how you do it. So I told this guy, let me talk to my sponsor, and I'll get back to you. The funny thing is for some reason I did that. I called my sponsor and I told him, I said, you got to sit down again for this one, Paul. You're not going to believe this. Can you believe some idiot is so far gone he would ask me for help? And he didn't laugh. I thought he was going to laugh. And you know what he did is he said, let me get this right. Are you telling me that you won't do for him what I'm doing for you? Oh, yeah, see? Somebody else heard that the way I heard it, right? It's like, damn. Never mind. And I told him I was scared. I was afraid I didn't know what to do. I said, I don't even know what to do with him. He said, dude, we just did this. And he said, and you've got my phone number. If you ever need help, just call me. And here's the other thing. It's in the book. And it really is. It really, really is in the book. And I can't tell you how many times I've had sponsees. People come to me with problems, and I'm thinking, I don't know how to fix that problem. And we just open the book and we start reading, and I'm like, I'll be goddamn, it's right there. It's crazy. There's a lot wrong with me, I'm sure. There's a lot right with me too, in all fairness. But I have instincts that drive me to take actions, behaviors. Some of those instincts, you know what, I'm going to say it a different way. All of those instincts are surely God-given, and they are good. The problem is, I don't use them in their proper proportion. There are some things that I ought to be doing that I don't do enough. And there are many, many things that I ought to be doing, but I need to stop doing too much of it. Do you follow what I'm saying? And so the problem is not my instincts; it's how they get utilized, right? That's where my biggest problems, I think, lie, is in proportion. And so I have found myself thinking that I sponsored half of Visalia at one time or another. That's of course not true. But I tell myself all kinds of fantasies. One of my sponsors suggested that I get into hospitals and institutions work. And I hope this might be humorous to you, but I found really quickly that there aren't a lot of people that'll do that work. And that's unfortunate for those people who won't do it, because it's really amazing work. But I go into jails, I go into institutions, treatment centers, I go out to the prisons, and I get a chance to be a part of what's happening in those institutions. And what I found is that most of the time, especially early on, I was the only one going. Now, I told you I like to talk, right? So, look, I mean, I'm not going to say every motivation that I've ever had has been good. But I really got into this H&I thing because it gave me an opportunity to go in and talk with people. And I just really thrive in that environment. And I think I'm maturing a little bit in that I still like to talk, but I'm learning how to listen a little bit better. And I think that's an important, a really important skill, listening. I don't do enough of it, I'm sure. Don't talk to my wife. She won't tell you any good things about that, I'm sure. I started off by telling you that the most important things, the best things that have happened in my life have happened when I've asked for help. And in the process of going through the 12 steps, we spend a lot of time talking about reflection. And step 10 is the taking continuous inventory and a regular inventory. And in step 11, we talk about prayer and meditation. And I don't know if any of you have struggled with prayer and meditation, but I know I didn't know. I thought I didn't know how to do any of that. And, you know, the crazy thing is that my parents, from my youngest years, took me to places to learn those things. They did everything they could for me to find what I needed. And I found myself as a young adult thinking that I didn't have what I needed. There's a guy in Minnesota, Minneapolis, that I've really become, I admire the guy, and I've become friends with him. I used to travel there often, and I got to meet him, and you know, he talks, you've probably heard this, people will say, if you want self-esteem, do esteemable acts. Have you heard that? If you want to feel good about yourself, do good things, that kind of thing. He has a little different angle on it, and I really kind of like it. He says, you know, the truth of the matter is that everything God gave you, you have, and it's this incessant sort of need that we seem to feel to possess other things that takes away from all of that goodness that we have. And so the key is about getting rid of, not adding to. I think that's probably something you have to kind of experience for yourself to understand what I mean. It's one of those kind of obtuse thoughts. I want to leave you with just one last thought, and it's from another guy that I admire, Bill C. In Southern California. You probably have heard people in AA say things like, you have to give it away to keep it, right? And I think there's some validity to that, but he says it a different way, and I think it's much more true. He says, if you aren't giving it away, you don't have it. And I'm amazed at how this process of recovery has repeatedly given me opportunities to receive blessings that are way beyond anything I deserve. I struggled understanding this whole God thing. And maybe this will be helpful for some of you, but what's happened for me is I've tried doing some things that I didn't understand at the advice of others. And the results that I've experienced have been undeniable. And what that's done for me is it's reinforced that the principles that we embrace here in our 12-step process of recovery are for my own good, that I benefit from everything that I do. And it almost, it's kind of weird. It's like it becomes selfish to give because I get so much in the practice of doing it. I think a good number of you were here Saturday night, and I don't know how your experience was Saturday night, but my heart just explodes with joy being around people that I genuinely enjoy being around who are all trying, to some measure or another, to be a better version of themselves. And I thank you for my life. Thank you.